Scott Arthur's is from Enfield, the one in Connecticut. Ever hear of it?
No, I'm not familiar with that town.
Well, apparently he's from that that general region, and at the age of 10, he was diagnosed with came down with this condition, a painful neurological condition. And with him is Dr. Muhammad Khalid from Bay State. He's a neurosurgeon that treated him. Guys, thanks for coming in.
Hey, no problem.
Thank you for having us.
So, Scott, what was it that that happened all of a sudden? And was it all of a sudden one day and it just didn't go away?
Yeah, it was all of a sudden. My family, we were actually in Lake George in New York for just a family trip. I woke up one morning, and I had this excruciating pain in my ear.
And you ruined the family vacation.
Yeah, it was. It was terrible.
I would imagine.
Me and my dad packed up, left.
Yeah?
My mom was like, you guys go, I'm staying.
So it was pain in one ear?
Yep, it started in the right ear.
Was it like a tinnitus, or was it something different?
The only way I could explain it, and I explained it to every doctor I've ever seen, was it felt like somebody was shoving a screwdriver right down my ear, right through my ear canal.
Phillips or a regular?
I would say Phillips, yeah. Phillips, for sure, yeah. For sure.
Metric?
Oh, no.
Now, and it was constant. It wasn't...
When it first started, it wasn't constant. It got to the point where it was about every 5 to 10 seconds.
Every 5 to 10 seconds for 1 second?
Yep. Just really? A shooting pain, now, and it would go away.
Now, you're 10 years old at the time.
Yeah.
And does this continue throughout your teen years?
Yep. Well, we went right down to... my dad drove me back. We went straight to Children's Hospital in Connecticut. We all thought it was an ear infection, and everybody did. I thought it was, my dad thought it was, everybody. Got put on medications, and 2 months later, I'm still in this excruciating pain.
Still?
Still.
None of the medication? Nothing. The medication, I can't even imagine the drive home from Lake George.
Oh, tears.
Yeah.
I mean, and of course, the tears lasted all the way until I was 26.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and it got to the point where they didn't know what was wrong with me, and they finally just said to my parents that they would just put me on as much medication that I won't remember being in pain.
Did they do that? I mean, I'm assuming they must have done MRIs or some kind of...
The funny part is I don't remember any of them. I got admitted into the Children's Hospital, and they told my parents they would just put me on so much medication that I won't remember being there.
How did you get through school, or did you?
I did for a while. I missed a lot. It got to the point where I had 504 plans, and all the way up to... I kept going through all this all the way through, and just being medicated, pain management, pain, everything.
Not hospitalized, though.
When I was 10, I was hospitalized for about 2 weeks. I don't remember any of it. But the crazy part is I woke up one morning and I had no more pain. It was just gone. So the hospital was like, we don't know what's going on. They just said, all right, we'll slap you with a trigeminal neuralgia diagnosis, which is in the face. Mm. All my pain was on the side and the back of the head.
When you woke up that morning and there was no pain anymore, did anybody at any point say to you, while you were asleep, we actually removed a screwdriver from your head?
No, never told me that. I wish, because that would make a lot of sense.
Right.
Yeah.
But it did come back.
Yeah, and it was gone for, I'd say, probably a year. And once again, I woke up one morning and it was back. And this time it didn't go away.
So was this known to be a neurological thing right away, or did they think this was like an auditory ear canal?
Originally, it was ear canals. I went to ear specialists. I remember one of the most painful things I went through, besides the pain, is they actually went and thought it was earwax, and they put a vacuum straight in my head.
A screwdriver.
Trying to get it out.
Yeah.
But, they thought it was an ear infection the entire time until I woke up that one day when I would say probably 12, and it was back. So back to the Children's Hospital I went.
So what age did you finally make your way to Bay State?
Oh, what, 24?
24 years old. And this has been going, this continued sporadically on and off.
Well, after 12, it never went away again.
It never went away.
It was both sides.
Yeah, and then, when I was 12, it came back, and it was on both sides.
So from the age of 12 to now you're 26, to 24 when you went to Bay State. Yeah. What made you, living in Enfield, what made you come up here?
Well, I started in Hartford, did all the rounds of Hartford hospitals, went all the way up to Boston, and we just started running out of ideas. And finally, 24, I went and saw my primary care doctor, and I was telling him, I was like, look, I'm out of options. I don't know what to do here. And he was like, well, I know good neurologist in Bay State, Dr. Johnson, who's my neurologist. So we went up there, and kind of we're stuck again. So we've did medications and all that, and I finally decided that with my parents we were going to go down to Johns Hopkins and try to figure something out there.
In Baltimore.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And right before we left, about 2 weeks out of leaving, Dr. Johnson said, hey, we have a neurosurgeon here, Dr. Kled. You probably should talk to him before you make any decisions about leaving. And I said, doesn't hurt. I've seen all these doctors. I'll go see him. And I went to Dr. Kled, and he told me that he thinks he knows what's wrong with me. And I laughed at him.
Well, then this is I assume, doctor, this is, you told him you knew what it was after an examination.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
And
so yeah. I start out with a differential diagnosis, which means I put in, okay, this could be A, B, C, D, or E.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to find out which one it is out of all of these, we have to do a few tests.
Did any other, and are you looking at all of the reports of all the previous doctors,
yes,
who have looked at him already? And did any of them do it in the same fashion that you did? Did they eliminate these other A, B, C, and Ds?
Some of them were already eliminated.
They were.
And some of them were not.
Okay.
So you're looking at Scott here, and you have a suspicion of what this is.
Yes.
What was it?
So my differential diagnosis included a few things. One of them was called Eagle syndrome, which is basically persistence or elongation of a bone in the base of the skull called styloid bone that can be pressing on certain nerves and causing pain. And the only way to find out if that is there is to just get a CT scan of the neck, upper part of the neck and the skull base, and see if it is persistently longer than it usually should be.
Which, again, I'm assuming somewhere along the line somebody had done that already.
Looking back at the things I had access to, no.
Nobody had done it. He said they did MRIs, but nobody did a CT.
I think the MRIs, these were of the brain.
Okay.
But I needed more of the skull base and the upper part of the neck, which is more neck territory.
From what'd you say, 10 years old to how old were you when you went and saw him?
24.
Well, I saw him. I was, 25 probably.
In all of that time, nobody did a CT scan of the neck?
The presentation wasn't quite typical for a few reasons. Number one, Eagle syndrome is very rare. It only exists in 0.16% of people, so 1 in 1,000 basically.
Mm.
And only 10% of those, so 1 in 10,000, have it on both sides.
But I would think an ear, nose, and throat specialist is going to look at the entire ear, nose, and throat plumbing system, which would include neck.
But they may
I
not look at the
skeleton for them.
Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. But they may not look at like skeletal evidence. I mean, they may just be looking at.
In 12 years, I think you'd be looking at everything.
Well, it's funny. Like you guys said, I'm not a doctor either. And he pulled me into the office and showed me the CAT scan and the CT scan, and he's like, "There it is." And I was like, what are you showing me? This is my skull. There's nothing there. And he plays it in like slow, and there was maybe 1/10 of a second. There was a flash of a little piece of bone, and he's like, "That's it." And
so what was it?
Not typical. The typical size of an enlarged styloid in this syndrome. Typically, it's very large. In his case, it was only 1 centimeter longer than it should be.
So, now, did it grow that one overnight when the pain began? Or, I mean, how does the pain all of a sudden just start?
That's an excellent question. It's not very clear with Scott because most people who present with Eagle syndrome are between 30 and 50 years old, and some are above 70 sometimes, very rarely in teenagers. So he's a rare, rare condition.
So if the bone was elongated, why was he not in constant pain? Why was it still intermittent pain?
His picture was a little bit atypical in the terms of the way it was presenting, and I can see why other physicians were thrown off. But the thing is that if we've learned anything through our medicine education is that almost no cases are textbook. Most people are a little bit off one way or the other than what the textbook describes any disease to be.
So what was the treatment?
So the treatment initially, I wanted to make sure that, yes, it's there, but is it the cause?
Mm.
I see the piece of bone. It's not as long as most styloid processes are in the patients with that syndrome. So I just wanted to make sure that that's the case. So I sent him to the pain medicine people to get an injection of something called this stellate ganglion, part of the nervous system that would affect the pain there and take care of it temporarily.
Mm-hmm.
And Scott went and got the injection, which helped with his pain on that side. Was the left side?
Yeah.
On the left side. And but unfortunately, he got terrible side effects. So he got good relief for pain, but terrible side effects.
Terrible?
I got it, and I actually, because I've gotten these injections before other hospitals, so I went, got this injection, went back to work. And 2 hours later, I'm passed out at work, got sent back to the pain. We didn't go to the hospital. We went back to the pain clinic, and ended up getting transported from there back to the hospital because I was so dehydrated and I was about to pass out.
Is the injection into the neck or into the ear?
What was this?
In the neck.
Yeah, it was
into the neck.
Yeah.
So the side effect was dehydration and passing out?
Yeah, it was crazy.
It just affected his nervous system. I think some form of vasovagal kind of
symptoms. Couldn't function. So I was only right down the road, but yeah, they had to call 911 and get me transported by an ambulance over there.
So eventually, the treatment was medication or surgery?
So eventually, I said, okay, this confirms the diagnosis, the fact that you got relief of pain from that injection. Let's do surgery. Now that he was having pain on both sides, we have to do one side at a time. And your pain was worse on the left side, so we decided to start with the left side. Now, in order to do this surgery, it's the approach is through the neck. So I had to call one of my colleagues, one of the ENT surgeons, Dr. Daniel Plosky, to do the approach for me, basically do the dissection until we reach the spot there, and then I take the styloid process out. So we did the surgery together.
I'm always amazed by this. Every time the doctors, the surgeons come in here and talk about the kinds of coordinated effort that needs to be done. So you need a... You need an ear, nose, and throat specialist to get you to that spot that he can't fix and you can't get to without him.
That is correct. It's just depending on our technical and surgical training. Each specialty is more trained in a certain set of skills and certain parts of the body that they're more comfortable with and more acquainted with to deal with surgically than others. And we coordinate if it's something that needs both our skills together combined, then we do that. And I work with him, for example, in removing tumors from the pituitary gland through the nose. He does the approach, and I go in and take the tumor out.
It's kind of like dentistry, where the dentist gets all the glory and the big fat paycheck, while the dental hygienist does all the heavy work,
yeah,
right?
But it also sounds like going to the mechanic, and you got one guy to open your hood, the other one to open the carburetor, and the other one to change the spark plug.
So you go through the surgery.
Yes, and the interesting thing that happened through during surgery is that he did the approach, and as soon as we got there, usually the anesthesia team is behind the drape, so they don't see what we're doing. And out of the blue, the anesthesiologist turned around, came over around the drape, came to our side, and is like, "What's going on, guys, there? What are you doing?" I'm like, "What's going on?" He said, "Why are you asking?" He said his pain level suddenly shot through the roof. So I was wondering, what are you guys doing?
The anesthesiologist can determine the pain level of a
During
sleeping
anesthesia,
patient?
Yes, so the heart rate went suddenly up. That tells them that he's starting to feel pain, severe pain. Breaking through the anesthesia that he's under. And then that kind of even more and more confirmed the diagnosis, because then we were touching the styloid process and the ligament around it, the stylohyoid ligament. Okay. And then we knew, yes, this is the source of the pain. When you push on it, it hurts him even more.
Now you're making me go off on a completely different subject. You hear these stories every once in a while about people who say that they were actually aware of their surgery while it was happening.
Yes.
If an anesthesiologist can see a patient's experiencing pain based on the monitors and things that they're hooked up to, how do those people not end up giving away the fact that they can feel all that pain?
So usually what they need to do at that point is just turn up the anesthesia medications that they're giving so that they go into a deeper sleep.
But oftentimes you hear that they say that there's no way that nobody in the operating room realizes that this person is feeling all of this.
That is correct. But I haven't had that happen maybe once in 17 years. I had a patient tell me that she was aware. And then but she wasn't under general anesthesia, though. She was under some sedation and local. So next time she needed surgery, I was like, okay, none of this for you. You're going under.
You're going out big time.
So you finished the procedure. Is when you wake up, is the relief immediate? I mean, what's the recovery for this?
Well, now your neck hurts.
Yeah, right.
No, yeah, that's what it was. I woke up and Dr. Kaledis, he asked me, "Are you still in pain?" I was like, "No." He's like, "Well, actually, even if you were in pain, you're on so much medication, you wouldn't be able to tell you're in pain." So the next morning he came in, no pain, sent me home that day.
How soon afterwards did you do the other side?
So I had told Scott that we need to wait for at least a month. Make sure that this is lasting effect before we go after the other side. Obviously, any surgery comes with a risk. And this surgery, we're working right close to the carotid artery, which is one of the main arteries that feeds the brain. So if that's injured, that's a major stroke.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be very careful and weigh the benefits against the risks for any procedure. So we did the side that was hurting most. And I told him, let's wait 1 month. And the surgery was in October, so we waited for another month. He was pain-free on the left side throughout that month. Said, okay, let's schedule the right side.
You know, the name of some procedures are obvious based on what you're doing. You know, colonoscopy, obviously, you're dealing with the colon. Appendectomy, you're dealing with the appendix. Where does the name Eagle Syndrome even come from?
It was the name of the physician, his last name, who first described that syndrome back in 1937.
Oh, really?
He was the first one who first described that syndrome of pain related to elongation of the styloid, abnormal elongation
yeah.
of the styloid
process. And right now, you're pain-free and have been for how long?
Since December 14th, my last surgery.
This past December 14th?
Yeah.
So in these 7 months, have you spent that time calling every other doctor you went to beforehand and telling them what it is and what a jerk they were for missing it?
I really have thought about it because it's unbelievable. Like, there's times, and I tell him all the time, I owe him my life. And anything he needs from me, I'll do it because it's amazing. Like, I've gone to all these doctors and nobody had a clue.
What are you making Scott do around the house?
The judge has actually bequeathed him to be his butler. But doctor, did he see other doctors that were, what is your official title?
I'm a neurosurgeon.
So he had seen other neurosurgeons?
I'm not sure that you've seen
neurosurgeons. Oh, no, you were the first.
I saw a lot of neurologists.
Neurologists mostly.
Yeah, and neurologists and
pain management.
And no neurologist previously said you should see a neurosurgeon?
No.
No.
Until, how did you end up finding Dr.
Karen Johnson? His neurologist had just shown up at Bay State. I was just hired, and she knew that I was into deep brain stimulation. That's my subspecialty that we talked about last year.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we do with deep brain stimulation is sometimes treat intractable pain. It's not FDA approved yet, but some people still go for it as a trial, and it works. In Europe, they do it more frequently, and in Canada. So she thought that he would be a candidate for deep brain stimulation for management of his pain. So I said, let's first make sure we're not missing an actual cause for this. Let's look deeper into that. So she sent me the message, and I told her, well, based on the description of the symptoms you're telling me, my differential diagnosis is A, B, C, and D, and one of them was Eagle syndrome. So, and then I didn't hear back from her for 3 months.
3 months?
And then 3 months later, she's like, okay, you're on. I'm sending him to you.
Did you ever previously have a patient with this syndrome?
No.
You never did?
No.
This was your first time?
No, my first, yeah.
Wow. That's wild.
Dr. Muhammad Khaled and Scott Arthur is from Enfield. This is an incredible story. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Glad you're feeling better.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. So what do you do for a living now?
Well,
he works on a runway. He's one of the baggage
sound
handlers.
Sound technician.
Yeah.
I think we're getting ready to move to Florida.
Really?
Yeah.
So what does that have to do with anything about what you do for a living?
Oh, I mean nothing. I'm going to interview with the post office today.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
why not?
Good for you.
Congratulations
to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Excellent work.
Yeah, that's wild, doctor.
726 of Bax and O'Brien, Rock 102.
Hey, it's Bax and O'Brien.